thanks for getting my pass. And she's like, this is my wife, Lilu. And she's like, she goes, holds up her ID. And she says, we can say it all together. This is my wife,
Lilu Dallas Multipass.
However, only says auto wash.
Yeah, and he mentions that he's pretty lucky that she ended up twice in his arms, and she goes, lucky.
And then he remembers Vito.
Yeah. He's like, what's that mumbling that you hear? It's like, Vito. And he goes over to the bed.
Who's been hermetically sealed under this plastic.
And he like rips over the plastic, and you see Ian Holm just shoot up being like,
okay, so we have, I think, maybe skipped the part where they kept cutting to all of the different three different elements of this story where everyone came up with the same plan. They're like, get the tickets to Phloxen, go there, get the stones, and then, I don't know, unknown, and then money or whatever the heck. You know, like that South Park, you know what I'm talking about? The underpants gnomes from South Park. Did you guys ever watch that?
No.
First, get all the underpants. Then, third, money. They have to get all the... Look it up sometime. It doesn't matter. they've all decided they need to get these stones because they're important to the weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And half of them want to get Lilu and half of them don't understand anything about her. But they've cut to everybody trying to get his tickets. And so we have set the priest free from the bed and Corbin has gone over to the window. And as Corbin and the priest are talking, the priest grabs one of the Corbin's awards and he's like, I'm very sorry, and smacks him on the back of the head.
He grabs the ticket, smacks Corbin, rushes out as Lilu is yelling at him like, oh, you weren't supposed to do this. Like, I know, I'm not proud of it. Yes. It's a really great exchange between those two.
Yes. They at some point exposit that David's going to pretend to be his husband because he's young and he's strong and I'm too old for you and he can protect you.
This is at the airport scene.
Mm-hmm.
This is also an airport scene that took place before 9/11. So there's like things like picking up boarding passes for someone else.
Yes.
That's a thing.
That's a whole thing. I almost couldn't mail a package yesterday because I didn't have my ID on me.
Oh, wow.
I just wanted to mail a perfectly benign package.
We were doing our taxes and I inserted my ID into her wallet and her ID into my wallet.
I was like, yes, here's my work ID so I can get a discount. And here's my, oh no. It was pretty funny. I was like, it's the same last name. He's like, I'm just going to check with your supervisor. I'm like, okay.
They just caught me at a very scruffy time in my life.
Oh, it's fine. I was like, oh, that was just a simple mistake. And it was fine. I got it mailed. Okay. So David and her step up to the concierge, we'll say, right?
Right. So it's David and Lilu step up and he's just sort of like really nervous. He's shaking all over the place. And she's just like, Mr. Dallas, congratulate. And he's like,
Yeah.
And she's like, congratulations on winning the contest. He's like, oh, okay. And she's like, sorry about the garbage. And
so sorry about the mess. The what?
The garbage. Yeah. And they both look behind. And then Lilu, when she looks, she notices that actual Corbin is coming up to pick up his boarding pass.
The trash is like huge. It's mm-hmm. like three stories tall. It is a lot of garbage.
It is the entire backdrop.
It's wonderful visually. I liked it a lot.
And there is a Sean fact about that. So Nick Dudman's Creature Crew created a group of spindly, long-nosed alien garbage collectors that never made it into the final movie. So in this, during the scenes with the spaceport, there's that huge pile of garbage, and in front of that pile is actually supposed to be these aliens holding sandwich board signs saying on strike.
I would have liked that.
Mm-hmm.
That would have gave context.
Definitely.
Right. I mean, I remember there being like garbage strikes in like New York and stuff. Probably sometime around this time. It was the civil service engineers. Is that what they're called?
I don't know. Service seems like it's made itself.
Sanitation workers, sorry.
Yeah, it's made itself in a few series, TV series that I can think of. Like maybe Simpsons referenced it. Maybe Seinfeld referenced it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big enough deal in several largely populated cities that, I mean, whereas we probably haven't had anything like that more than like a week off of garbage pickup because of inclement weather. Like, mm-hmm. the idea of a city that just rolls out garbage continuously. It just gets overwhelmed so quick. Mm-hmm. It just gives mass to the fact that there are 200 billion people on this planet.
Right.
That's amazing. That's crazy. That's insane. We think there are too many people now. There are 8 billion people-ish.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, in the movie, it's just like, well, that's JFK. They don't have any context for why all this garbage is here.
Right.
Okay, so Corbin comes up and he's like, I didn't know if I was going to make it on time. I had David come and get this. See, this is me. And he holds up his ID. He's like, look at me. I'm Corbin Dallas. This is my wife. We're so much in love. Thanks for getting my pass. And she's like, this is my wife, Lilu. And she's like, she goes, holds up her ID. And she says, and we can say it all together. This is my wife,
Lilu Dallas Multipass.
Lilu Dallas Multipass.
Yeah,
and then David, she just keeps saying it.
Yeah, and he's like, yeah, it's a multipass.
They get it. She gets it. She knows what a multipass is. Yeah. This is my driver's license. The Lilu Dallas driver's license. Like, she knows what a driver's license is.
But David runs over to Vito, who's like drinking at the bar and being like, oh, she's so strong and she's so, you know, but she's also so frail. And I'm just like, she doesn't need protecting. She's like this all-powerful being.
And chatting up the robot. Bartender.
And the bartender's just, and he asks the bartender, do you know what I mean? And the bartender just shakes his head, no. Would you like another?
And so David steps in, takes his drink out of his hand, slams it back. He goes, yes, make it a double.
Yeah.
And Vito turns and he's like, what?
Yeah. And so he explains to Mr. Dallas that Corbin showed up and grabbed all of the stuff. And
I didn't know what to do. I thought he was going to kill me.
And Vito's like, I shouldn't have sent you. And his response is, I know. Also, this is where I put my note. David is like the kid who took drama thinking it would be an easy passing grade and turned into like the best actor. And now he's got all of this responsibility. And he's like, I just thought I could do this.
Nice, quiet clergy position. And now I have to do all this running around for like, oh my God. Okay, so Vito says, I'm going to get on that ship, right?
Right.
And he hands David the key and he's like, and you have to go get the place ready. Would you like to follow me down a tiny, 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 tiny rabbit hole?
Sure.
Okay. So about a bazillion years ago, we watched a giant cockroach duck face steampunk alien get smooshed.
Yes.
By those doors in that temple.
Oh, yes.
David says, I don't want to go to Egypt. Right? And all I can think of is him putting that key in that door and it pulling apart all sticky-like and this giant 2-ton cockroach
duck-faced
steampunk mechanoid just clambering to the floor. Unless the previous priest had gone into this temple and like cleaned that out, that's what David was going to Egypt to do, mm-hmm. was to dispose of the body of their godlike alien creatures. And if that's what he did, right? Because when we enter, okay, I'm so sorry. When he get there later, there's no sign of that creature, right? So we assume it's been cleaned up. If he's been sent there to prepare, why is there so much dust and shit everywhere? Mm-hmm. What is David doing in Egypt, guys? Is he disposing of a body? Or is he cleaning out a temple? Because I don't see much of either. And now you can climb out of the rabbit hole.
Ew, David.
Ew, David. Are you a Schitt's Creek fan?
No, but I should
watch
be.
It. Watch the whole thing. Yeah. Watch it.
Okay.
Tip to tail.
Okay.
And I have a tissues for only like 2 times.
Okay.
You will love Dan Levy.
I already do.
Okay, well, you love him more.
Yeah. Does it have Catherine O'Hara in it?
Yes, it does.
Mm-hmm.
She goes, oh, you are all my little babies.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. We are now to the part where the movie becomes much more palatable.
Yes. So they're going into the area where they're boarding onto the spaceship, and Corbin gets pulled aside because he is the winner of this contest, and he has to meet Ruby Rod. Ruby Rod is a radio personality.
Yeah.
And the contest is the Gemini Croquette contest to win a trip to Flossdom Paradise.
Yeah.
But Ruby's like the face of it. We don't really see much about Gemini Croquette.
Yeah, I don't know what that is.
Yeah, it's a person. So he goes ahead and he gets shuffled off into this hallway. We are introduced to Chris Tucker playing Ruby Rod as this radio personality. He's got like this
leopard print ensemble.
The only kind of outfit that he wears is like this onesie with like a collar that just drapes down.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say that it drapes. It's more of in Project Runway, and this is for Madeline. She's allowed to, because we were Project Runway fans for a long time. I believe that his outfits would qualify for the avant-garde challenge because he's got these... They're these couture challenge, maybe. Oh, correct me, Madeline. You know what I'm talking about. It's because it's over the top. It's this eye-catching thing. And that's all Ruby's persona is. Like, he catches your eye. He catches your ear. He keeps you engaged. That's his whole deal, right?
Right.
But also, do we also cut back to the priest sneaking onto the ship now?
Okay, so not just yet. He kind of... Actually, before they actually board the plane, we get two more instances of people picking up tickets. Mm. One is a couple with Mangalores because they change their faces. Mm-hmm. So one of them changes his face so he looks like Corbin Dallas, but he doesn't pass the scan check. Right. And then he his face is like changing. And so they like have to make a quick mad dash. And that's when the police come in and they're like, the Mangalores shoot at the police, dive into the garbage, and then they make their escape that way. Mm-hmm. But then we have another guy who is coming to pick up the tickets.
The Zorg assistant.
Zorg's right hand.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes ahead and he comes up and he's like, I'm Corbin Dallas. And she's just like, really? I already have one Corbin Dallas on here and he's already boarded. And be like, oh, that's not possible because I'm the real Corbin Dallas.
Boarding is now completed.
And she like goes down. She like just like
he's
elevator.
Like, come back. You have to talk to me. He goes and he smacks the glass and mm-hmm. gun turrets come down on either right. side of him and in front of him. And mm-hmm. it's like, this is a police matter. Right. Please remain calm. Place your hands on the yellow circles. And right. he's like,
right. And Vito ends up getting through security because all of the security is paying attention to the Mangalores during that segment.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah.
Because I was like, inept priest sure got on that ship super easy.
Yeah, and then he like is going into the boarding, and while Corbin is going through and seeing everything, he sees like Vito kind of come through the door and then leave through the door. They make eye contact. But essentially, it's just the moment before actual liftoff is where... him and Corbin are just like going through the hallway.
We're talking about the walkthrough with Ruby.
Right.
Yes. There are this scene is so fantastic. There are selfies. There are fangirls. There's energy. There's hype men. There's hair. There's outfits. There's sex. There is everything mm-hmm. about Ruby Rod.
Right. And he is like so over the top. This was like, this came out before his big hit with Jackie Chan, right? The Rush Hour?
I think so.
Yeah. So this was like, you know, pre-Rush Hour.
Oh, yeah. This is nothing to lose, Tucker.
Right.
Chris, another trucking to lose, Tucker.
Yeah. And he goes hard on it. Like, this is a character that you could easily kind of mess up. Mm-hmm. But I think that Chris Tucker, like, takes it to that extreme.
He is an embodiment of a personality. And it doesn't feel like he's making fun of... an orientation. It doesn't feel like he's making fun of effeminate persons or any kind of like, a lot of times black persons in entertainment have a lot of stereotypes. Sometimes we've talked about before, mm-hmm. like put upon them. Like it is not his blackness that makes his character fantastic. It is just this persona that is so powerful and put forth with such energy that like when I was writing notes about it, I was like, it's from 5 o'clock in the afternoon until 7 o'clock in the afternoon, right? 2 hours of maintaining that level of energy, even in theory, mm-hmm. is exhausting
right.
to me. But I'm just so impressed with his character. He's easily my favorite character.
Right.
Easily.
Costuming could have made this a real issue for me, just because there's one of those stereotypes of black entertainment is black men dressing up in female clothing as a way to emasculate. There's a very... stylistic sense about the whole movie. How would you look at that thing and say that's weird on the costuming side, but not look at all the stewardesses? Like, there's a definite stylistic acceptance that the future is hypersexualized. So I'm just going to go with that and say that that's fine.
It's a universe choice.
Right. And unfortunately, this is so early on in Chris Tucker's history of work that we can't really say, you know, would he have not taken this role or accepted it if the costuming was a certain way? You know, it's definitely pre-woke.
Yeah, but he's such an icon. Like, I just love him so much in this. And I don't know if there's some bias blocking me from seeing something that would be more socially correct. But like, I don't know. I think this is one of the times when I just love a character, feel like he's powerful. I feel like he doesn't have to be apologetic. And he's that way through the entire film. And although that doesn't speak to an arc, really, he's just glorious.
So his original name, the character's name, Ruby Rod, was actually Luke or Loke, L-O-C, Rod, in the book. And it appears that way in the script as well. But Sean points out that if you look at the periodic table, rubidium is the first of the period five elements, and exactly halfway along that row is the element rhodium. So if you take the first half of those two elements together, you get ruby rod, rubidium and rhodium. And then other people, Sean says, have just speculated that it's kind of a gender-bending name. So you have ruby, which is generally accepted to be a feminine name, but rod would be a very phallic name. That's what Sean said. Phallic. I'm using that word specifically so I don't get in trouble.
I reserve the right to laugh anytime Sean writes the word phallic in his notes.
There's a part of me that feels like this movie is meant to try and, you know, expand on what gender is. Obviously not so much with the straight cis white men in this movie. Like, you don't see any real deviation from Corbin Dallas. I mean, outside of, like, you could surmise that because of the fact that he wants to settle down, he's like, it's always like this major part of his character. And that's not always something that you see in movies where a man is very vocally saying that he wants to be in a relationship with just one woman. It's not going as full down that path as it does for, like, Mila's character or Ruby Rod. Like, I would think that of the main actors, Ruby Rod is, like, not just iconic, but because of the amount of stuff that his character does later on and how essential that he is. I mean, he's there till the very end, mm-hmm. and he's kind of integral to the plot happening. Mm-hmm. There's a part of me that feels like he's supposed to be up there with the main cast.
Oh, 100%.
Right. So there's a part of me that feels like there was this attempt to be a little bit like, gender is more of a gender is more fluid than we probably give it an option to. And I mean, this was back in the 90s. There was a lot of, like, you know, trying to make women into more powerful, showing them as being more powerful than some of their other counterparts. Though I have some notes about how she does get regulated to of a love interest.
We definitely need to talk about that.
So
the show ends, right? He's like, Corbin, what does he ask him?
The show ends. He, like, grabs a cigarette and he's asking
No, but before, he says something on the show.
Oh, yeah.
He wants Corbin's input on something on the show.
Yeah, he just asks, I don't remember the exact question that he asked. He's like, he probably asked him, are you excited to be here? And he says, thrilled.
No, he says thrilled at the opera house.
Oh, okay.
But his answers are two words in this scene and one word in the opera house.
Yeah, because he asked him not to be a two-word guy at the opera house.
Yeah.
It's hilarious.
Yeah, can you have more than a two-word vocabulary?
Yeah, because he's trying to get him all excited because he's this contest winner. He's supposed to be engaged like that.
Well, yeah.
But then the show ends. He pops a cigarette out of a fancy cigarette dispenser. Mm-hmm. Then his yes men come up and just start yesing.
And that's when he was like, so how was it? And they were like, oh, it was so good. It was so green. It was like, how kind of green was it? It was like, it was super green. It was crystal green. It was any kind of green you want.
Then he goes over and he admonishes Corbin. He's like, hey, can you have more than two words next time on the show? I'm trying to do a show. You're not helping me. And so Corbin's just like, can you talk with me for just a second? Grabs him by his throat, puts him up on the wall. And he's just like, I'm here for a vacation. I'm not here to be on your stupid show.
Right.
Isn't that basically it?
Yeah. And he was like,
I'm not here to be a Pumbaa. And I'm trying to remember, is he referencing Lion King as, like, being a sidekick to some scrawny, mouthy guy? Can it be? Can I have that?
Yeah, you can totally have that.
Because wouldn't it be like a classic reference? Like, I'm not here to be the
Laurel to your Hardy.
I'm not here to be your Romeo to your Mercutio. Like, it's like a classy reference now in context. I'm not here to be your Pumbaa, Timon.
Yeah, I will say this. I could watch a TV show with just a super hyper performative character and then another one that says, like, one word. Like, as far as characters go, I could see the two of them in, like, a show, and that could just be the entire show.
It's like Jay and Silent Bob, kind of.
Yeah,
I was thinking Pinky and the Brain, but I'm not as creative as you. Okay, so they're all getting set up for stasis. Corbin rolls in to the bunk with Lilu, and she knows English now.
Right. And he's just sort of like, look, this is a dangerous mission and you have to stick close to me or else you're going to get hurt. And she's just like, no, I'm the divine being. I'm here to protect you.
She says, I'm the fifth element.
Yeah.
And that's not true. But she's like, I'll take care of you. And that is also not true.
Oh, and they're turning on these sleep regulators to go ahead and put them to sleep. And
it's like a 4-hour trip, right?
I don't know.
I don't remember, but like the idea of like, because we're on a very short timeline. Mm-hmm. I'll be in Flossed in less than 4 hours.
Well, the show ends at like 7 p.m. And right. then when they come in, it's like at what, 3 p.m. the next day?
Yeah.
So it's probably like a full day.
Oh, okay. But that stasis for that long?
I don't know. But I did note that when Corbin like gets knocked out, I like to think that Lulu stays up so she can just learn language and everything.
Yeah, she for sure would not be taken in by some sleeping gas from the Martians.
Yeah. And this is where we get the scene where it shoots back between different areas.
Montage.
Yeah. And so you have like, you have a scene of...
I got a list.
Do you want to go for it?
If you want to like just... Because here's the thing, guys. Like it is in all of our movies, we can spend the next 20 minutes explaining this, or I can list you out right now.
Just list it.
Okay, so there's takeoff sex between Ruby and Stewart, right? There's a reggae flamethrower guy. There is instant sleep. There is nuclear reactors. There is dude smoking weed. There are mutant tribbles. Cronenberg universe, question mark? There's, you can call me Ruby. There's, yeah! There is... rainbow jacket on they cut to Zorg, and then there's that countdown that is probably super wrong. There is blow up your guy moment where Zorg takes out his own guy who's like, I'm sorry, it'll never happen again, and he blows him up, and then there's takeoff and they leave the atmosphere.
When the ship leaves Earth for Flossed in Paradise, there's a constellation, and would you like to guess what the shape of that constellation is? It's the shape of a cat walking with its tail straight up in the lower left, right above the rim of the Earth.
Why? Why? Why is that a thing? Why do I know it now? Why didn't I notice it before?
It's there because probably as a link between Corbin telling his cat not to watch that junk on TV with Flossed being in there. And I don't know. It's just in there.
Okay. It's there because the last movie we did was Cats.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay, so the only thing that I want to point out from this montage, which is a lot of information really fast about like the priest getting trapped in the thing on purpose and all of that, right? Is I want you to remember what, and this is going to be important later, so put it in your toolkit. And this is on, hey, plotters, I'm about to say something real uncomfortable. So if you got children, I'll hold back. This is on representations of women having orgasms in media. The stewardess has one. Remember what her face looks like?
She looks like she's...
She just throws her head back, her mouth is open.
Yeah, she kind of looks like it's not necessarily enjoyable, it's painful, or it's...
Well, I think she's enjoying herself.
Yeah.
We're going to assume enjoyment. It's certainly consensual. I just want you to remember that look on her face for later, because I'm going to get real mad about it.
Okay.
Okay, so now I was... Okay, so now we... Shut up. Don't. It's my whole thing.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
You know, you can take a note if you need to that is f***ed up and I know we have to talk about it.
Yeah. Okay.
Right?
I know.
Hey, so we see the ship that looks kind of like the Challenger. It's like a flat NASA looking, kind of even flatter, but probably bigger looking ship, right? It's going to dock with the Flossed ship, right? And all I could think when they were docking was a floating cruise ship has got to be so much better for the whales. But now I don't think maybe they don't have whales on that planet. I went on a whale watching trip once and with Lucas and your aunt, Jen, your aunt. And they were like, we can't stay here too long because of the noise pollution and it's hurting the whales and we're killing the whales. But let's go look at the whales. And I'm like, complicated. I watched Blackfish last year. I don't want to hurt the whales. I just want to look at them. And so then I was like, oh, this, a floating cruise ship would solve that problem, wouldn't it?
I would think so.
But then maybe they don't have whales.
Maybe the whales from Earth were transported to that planet, a la that Star Trek movie where they transported whales.
It's the only Star Trek movie I've seen
ever.
No, that's not true. But like, it's the old one that I like.
Yeah.
And apparently if you like the one with the whales, you're a bad Star Trek fan. Sorry. I like the one with the whales.
Maybe they just jumped ship and said so long.
I was just thinking maybe they materialized above the ocean this time.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this is where the dolphins are from.
Oh, yeah.
And they're not there because they haven't poofed back yet. Or maybe they returned to Earth because it's Earth 2.
Right.
Well, there's so many references. Okay, so how do we feel about the Hawaiian Pacific Islander representation as they exit onto the cruise ship?
This was giving me some Joe versus the Volcano flashbacks, and I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah, but that was like a made-up weird tribe.
Yeah, I mean, these look like actual Polynesians.
Yeah. Like the certainly the band that's singing them in looks like it might have been a legit band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, though it's a little bit like this is a caricature of... So I've never been to Hawaii.
Okay.
And so I could just be talking fully out of my ass as an ignorant white woman. But
it happens.
I am almost certain that this idea of going into Hawaii and then you're like kind of flooded with all of these people giving you lays and everything is like a caricature of the Hawaiian culture. Like, have you ever, have you actually done, do you know the basic history of?
Oh, you mean Captain Cook?
No, I'm talking about how Hawaii, like less than 100 years ago, was like a sovereign nation until the United States came in and said, nope.
Well, I know that it's the only...
It'd be like just over 100 years ago at this point. Sorry.
I know it's the only state that has a queen.
She used to until like America took over.
She's not recognized as the...
No, I don't think that they have a monarchy anymore because America took over.
Oh, I don't like that. I thought I had a fun factoid about them actually still having a royal family.
Really?
I thought, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. But okay, yeah. So what the thing that only stuck in my head was that I was talking to my coworker. Say, I'm sorry, yeah. Shane. I don't mean to name drop you this whole freaking time. But he was talking about this guy that he follows on TikTok. He was talking about this guy who's from Hawaii, and he was talking about how this individual speaks and then gave me his name, which happens to have the name Howley in it. And I was like, I thought Howley means from off island, right? My ignorance. And Shane informs me, he's like, no, Howley just means white guy. You can be from Hawaii or like, you know, born there. And if you just have white skin, you're a Howley. And I was like, oh, right. So then I'm watching the movie today and I was like, oh, I guess I shouldn't be really upset about that white guy putting lays on people and being all up in there because maybe he is like a born with it.
Okay, so
I don't get why they're there.
Because it's paradise.
And paradise has to have Hawaiian people.
It's
or Pacific, you know, Polynesian, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so it feels like they're trying to like kind of like put this through like this is paradise. I don't know. Like it doesn't seem to really mean anything. You could have done anything at this point. And you could have just, it still could have been like happy jubilation.
They wanted beaches. It's got beaches. It's got sand. Where's relatable that's got beaches and got sand? I get it.
Right.
I don't know. It feels weird because like you're in space. You could do like literally anything. Mm-hmm. And you decided something very, very familiar that you could get at home.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll just take it as a choice. The wonder of entering the luxurious and exotic yet somehow American Hawaiian
human
stereotype.
Like they make little like drops that, you know, like maybe there are aliens in this universe, but we don't really know.
Well,
like,
there is. There's the what's the McCollets and the other guys.
Yeah, that's right. But there's still like, you know,
this is all humans all the way down except for the ones who sneak in.
Right. So is this something that was previously occupied?
It certainly seems like an environment that would, but you know, it's too much. It's mm-hmm. too much. We're reading
yeah,
too much into
yeah.
It's supposed to be this jovial thing and look how much fun they're having. And there's a guy with a ukulele who looks like he could have written some song that he's probably singing right now. That's good. And then we pan away from them and the only remnants of it is the lady taking him to the hotel room who happens to be wearing a print.
The important thing about this is that Lilu and Corbin have separated. Corbin's in his hotel room and Lilu's just, you know, somewhere in the hotel.
She's being guided, I feel like.
Yeah.
Her perfect self is being guided towards her end goal.
Right. And in the hotel room, you see everything's kind of been like...
Wait. Yeah. Jen pointed something out in this Hawaiian scene that I should mention. They give you facial kisses as you get off the ship. And Jen's like, not that. Not for me. Never again. Never before. Never again.
Yeah.
Particulates.
Gross.
Yeah.
Oh, why when the priest falls through the ceiling into the hallway, so the ship is docked, the captain of the ship is like, hey, there's something giving off a thing in the thing. And the other guy's like, yeah, I'm going to go check it out. And as he walks into the hallway, the priest falls down, right? Why is he not immediately arrested?
Well, we don't see the arrest.
Wait, I don't think he is arrested.
No, I think he is arrested.
Oh.
Yeah, it's just we don't see it right away. He was the one who was captured by the Mangalores. And when the Mangalore said hands up, he like this is after the opera.
Oh, his hands are up. It's how they got him. He was probably in a holding cell somewhere.
Right.
Okay. So okay, the mystery solved.
Yeah, he wasn't immediately arrested because the guy who spotted him, you know, wasn't a police officer.
Okay, so now we're in Corbin's hotel room.
Right, and the lady is kind of like going through everything, and he's, you know, like, I really like this Plava Laguna diva. Can I get tickets to her show? It's like, oh, you already have it because you're the winner. And he's like, okay, can I get a new outfit? And she like presses a button on the wall, and there's all of these like suits that come out.
She's like, enjoy your evening. Enjoy your stay, Mr. Right. Dallas.
Oh, and like, we didn't bring this up the last time, but Corbin is called by his mother three times. The first time is right after he wins the contest, and he doesn't even know he's won.
Mm-hmm.
The second time is here in the hotel room where
I can't believe I wouldn't push you out of my body. I can't believe that you went there without me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's angry that he didn't take her on this trip, though. It's like, you know, there's reasons for it.
For real.
And she also finds him at the hotel
and manages to get through to his room.
Mm-hmm.
My gosh.
Like, that is a tenacious woman.
She where does
is
not
the
stop.
Where is the movie about her?
Yeah. Well, but in this scene, I've noticed that Corbin is incredibly courteous to service industry members.
Right.
He's great with the Thai guy, mm-hmm. enough that he hangs out with him after giving him food and gives him free food.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's super nice, even though she's just like, I love Ruby Rod. He's just the greatest. And he doesn't like Ruby Rod.
Right.
But he was nice to her because she's nice enough to him. And like, mm-hmm. that's great.
Yeah.
I will judge the shit of you on how you treat somebody who's in service to you.
Mm-hmm.
I will like no hold back. No holds barred. I will be like, oh, is that how you are?
Mm-hmm.
You view people as lesser?
Mm-hmm.
Then I hate you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I will dismiss you faster than I will dismiss my guilt over a library fee.
Right. Then we cut to the diva mm-hmm. or like the diva kind of walking through the hotel.
Mm-hmm. Oh, is the diva here yet? He asks the lady and she's like, not yet. And then she does arrive.
Yeah. And that's when we see the head of security guy who's all like freaking out about her. And she's super tall.
Mm-hmm.
And
she's veiled and she's surrounded by people with skull face masks on.
Right. And they're bringing all of her luggage in. And she like leans over to one of her helpers, who's a bald lady. In a really nice outfit. I love
she,
that outfit.
Yeah, she doesn't say anything though.
Right.
Like she just leans over and they like have like a forehead to forehead moment.
Right.
And then they enter the room with the really nervous liaison guy who's like trying to fill out, I'm sure, some sort of absurd writer. And then the lady, bald liaison, no, bald assistant.
Yeah.
She goes over and she stands in front of a plaque in front of a wall and she looks like she's talking to the plaque and she's just like, the diva would like you to know that she's very pleased that you are here and she will give you what you came for after the show. And then it kind of pans to the side and there's Lilu listening.
Right.
This is the one Bechdel pass.
It passed.
But, ish.
Yeah. She's like, they're not even face to face.
Oh, so they're not in the same room.
Right. And there's no exchange of dialogue like on both ends. It's only like with one of them. So there's a part of me that
I don't know that lady's name.
Yeah.
She's unnamed as far as I know.
Right.
Oh, no.
So.
Suck.
Yeah.
I was so sure. We were so close. I was going to be so happy. Oh. Mm. But now it's 5:00.
Right. Which means it's time for Ruby Rod's show.
Okay. So he's just like, welcome to Flossin' Paradise. Right. He's got Bantu knots in his hair, I think. I think that's what they're called.
Right.
They're adorable. And they're like these, because they're like a wound kind of knot in his hair, they look a bit like a rose, which are the roses in this circlet kind of like collared shirt that's all bowed out with this beautiful mm-hmm. gold necklace. And it's like this skin tight suit. And he's just like waving his stick in the air. Oh my mm-hmm. God. He's just, this is my favorite outfit of his.
Yeah.
It's glorious.
Yeah. And he's going through this opera hall.
He said the Great Opera House, and I think it's supposed to be the Paris Opera House, but mm-hmm. never. I don't know.
Right. And he's pointing out different people, like there's a laser ball, the king of laser ball. There's like a bunch of ministers, more sinisters than ministers. And they're just like a bunch of like officials talking around each other.
Yes, the deaf guy. What's his face?
Baby Roy. He's like star of...
Stage and screen.
Yeah.
But he won't get much out of this concert because he's stone cold dead.
Yeah.
And then he's like, oh, and then there's this foreign minister and his daughter. And she said to me, I love singing. She told to me recently. And I have a sample right here. And then it starts. I was about to imitate it. Oh, no. Oh no. No, I'm not. Don't look at me in that tone of voice. I'm not going to do it. But he pushes a button on his microphone and it starts making the moaning noises. And he's like, I'll play the rest of it for you after the end of the concert.
Yeah.
And that's naughty.
Yeah.
He do be dip banging ladies, though.
Yeah.
He do.
And so they, and then he asks Corbin how he feels about being here. And Corbin just responds with thrilled. But
yeah, thrilled. And as he sits down, he goes, and he's like, ah. And then he turns around and he's just like, commercial, commercial.
Yeah. And he taps someone on the back.
Champagne.
And it's the guy turns around. Now, another thing we didn't bring up is one of the Mangalores have a specific face. Mm-hmm. The leader has a face on him.
Yeah.
And it's the same face that we see on the service industry guy.
Oh, yeah. So this, you know, waiter turns around and we instantly recognize him as our Mangalore. And right. Rob takes his headset goes, 30 seconds of commercials. And he grabs this champagne and the guy walks away. He confirmed Dallas is there. And so then he goes and reports back to the other Mangalores in like some service room. And it's just like, hey.
Do you remember what he says right before the show starts?
No, what?
He says, showtime. And then the show starts.
Brilliant.
And that's when the diva comes out and she is like this tall blue lady mm-hmm. with like this, I can only call it like a horn, but it's not like, but it's just like going from the top of her head to curling back.
It's kind of like a Twi'lek of Star Wars, but only one of them instead of two.
Right.
I said that because of her shape and the black rigging she's got over her outfit, it gave me alien vibes. So if you come somewhere between Twi'lek and the alien, I feel like you get somewhere close, especially if you mix in a little Smurf.
Right.
But you're right about that. You're right about that like soft, swooping head shape that goes around to a curl.
Right.
And it's hard to tell what is her outfit and what is her.
Mm-hmm.
Because certainly when she gets... never mind, we'll get there.
Yeah. And so she does this whole like operatic song in like a foreign language. Does Sean's notes mention what language it is? Because it doesn't sound like... It's not English.
It's an Italian opera.
It's Italian. Okay. It sounded Italian. And so she's singing it. And as she's singing, there's like cutting between her singing and what's going on at her room.
Well, the first half of the song is this beautiful, simple but not easy,
right,
operatic piece that is beautiful and compelling. And you see everybody becoming engaged, right? And we see a little bit of the back of the Mangalores invading her suite to steal the stones.
Mm-hmm.
And we see Leeloo having a problem with this. And then we see the song cue cut in half. And she then starts this vocalization, hip hop, like beautiful tone scaling back and forth, up and down. Just this, I mean, the first time you hear it, are you not floored?
Oh, I know. It's amazing.
And it's just like, oh, and like, oh, like that she, like, and it's not the Satrus, it was somebody else, but like it was really sang.
Well, I like to think that there are certain notes that the vocalist is actually singing, but you can tell that there's like auto tuning with it. And there's a part of me that likes to think that like the rigging that she's the black that is embedded into like this character's body is supposed to help with that.
It's possible.
I really like that idea.
Well, but I've also seen people perform pieces like this.
Really?
Without assist. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
It's a legit thing. And Shane was saying that it was real.
Okay.
So it's entirely possible that it was done without. It's the late 90s. It could have totally been in there too. It doesn't really matter. What I think we're supposed to get out of the film as it transitions from her mastery of music and our vision of seeing Leeloo fight these Mangalores is that they're both masters
mm-hmm. of their craft.
Divas, if you will. They're both divas, if you look at it a certain way. And here's where my notes get a little... No, they're always bad. How is it that this perfect creature, she loses her temper and goes after the Mangalores? And I don't think that if you're perfect... I mean, in my mind, a perfect person doesn't lose their temper like that, you know? I mean, like, certainly be angry and be righteously angry when you need to be. And certainly, you know, go to war if you have to. But like they're stealing some stones and she just loses it. And it's like hilarious in some of like the, mm-hmm. boop, 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 you know, like punch sorts of scenarios that she has within this fight scene. But the fact that she was like, yes, I myself will take on a dozen Mangalores. Mm-hmm. It doesn't ring thoughtful to me.
Yeah, I think there's like this flashback back to the destruction of the ship. And I think that's what's supposed to kind of like trigger her. And so she's like, okay, these guys are trying to get the stones. They're ultimately helping the people who want to destroy everything. And so I think that's how she justifies it.
She literally kicks a sword in half.
I mean, yeah.
But they both, did you notice that they both end with the same stance where they're like,
yeah.
So Corbin's the first one to stand up in front of the diva because he's at the concert. And he's like, yeah. Ruby stands up next to him and he goes, bravo, bravo. And then it cuts back to the suite. Mm-hmm. And Zorg walks in and goes, bravo, bravo.
Yeah. Yeah, the cuts in this movie are just really on point.
Satisfying.
Sean would like to point out that the opera singing is an example of diegetic performance.
I think I got it wrong in our last podcast where I was going off about like diegetic and non-diegetic.
So. Okay, I think he was right, and that's why he was inserting it.
Okay. Oh, cool, cool.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. I'm thinking, yeah, I wasn't, it rang true to me too.
Okay.
No, it's okay to be wrong.
Yes.
But you were correct.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So then he goes ahead and asks her for the stones, and she has this box that she's holding. And so she throws it at him, and then she makes this like parkour leap up into the ventilations
she
again.
She grabs the Art Deco filigree above her and like does this smooth flip into the ceiling. And I'm like, damn.
Yeah. And so he starts shooting in the ventilations to try and like stop her from coming after him. He stays a good chunk of time inside this room trying to like stop her, which, I mean, he doesn't have to. He just has the box and he can pick up and leave.
Yeah.
And I think at that point, we do see some of the Mangalores. Like one of the Mangalores, like who sees Lilu attacking the other ones, goes running off and says to all of the other ones that it was a trap. We've been ambushed. And then the leader is just like, then if they want war, then we'll give them war. And so that's when like all hell breaks loose and the Mangalores come into the opera house around everybody else, says things like, we're taking you all hostage, blah, 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 blah.
But that opera house clears so fast. I mean, I know humans. Like, have you ever left a stadium? Like, it's unreal. Right. It's unreal when 20 people have to leave through two separate doors. The fact that there was hundreds of people watching this diva, ridiculous.
Right.
Okay, so guns are going off. People running out of the thing. The whole place is going crazy.
Boom, 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 boom. Shots fire, shots fire, shots fire. One shot, it's the diva in the stomach.
And she falls dramatically to the ground. Mm-hmm. Corbin, okay, I don't know about you, but the way he sweeps her up in his arms and off the stage, I was like, oh.
Yeah.
I was like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
He was very gentle.
Yeah, but like very like, I've got you. Mm-hmm. And I was like, ooh, ooh.
Yeah.
Hi, Bruce. Yeah. Hey, Bruce. How you doing? That's a nice tuxedo. A nice borrowed tuxedo. Nothing like a man in a rented suit.
Okay. And so,
he and the diva have a little talk.
Yeah, and he's just like, where are the stones? I think actually before she gets shot, that's when Zorg plants the bomb. Because again, this movie is really good about cutting back and forth between different things, and he has already made an escape. So he like plants the bomb. He goes back to his ship, makes an escape.
Well, I think he's sitting in the dock.
No. I think he like actually leaves the dock.
Oh, wow.
Because he does come back. But I could be wrong about that. But essentially, when he opens up the case to see if the stones are there, that's when she says that the stones are in me.
Yes. But she also says you need to take care of her. You need to love her. She is more vulnerable than she seems. And I was like, way to go. You speak once, diva. You speak once and you give the entire plot away.
Yeah. And also she says, and she needs your love.
Yes. And then she's like, the stones are in me. She doesn't sound like an old lady, guys. She has the most beautiful voice, the most beautiful teeth, the most beautiful blue blood that she smears on his face.
She sounds like Southern Oracle to me.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
From the NeverEnding Story.
Okay, you do the voice then, Jen.
Oh, ha-ha. Oh, it's a soprano voice.
I can't do a soprano voice anymore. Any more than you can, is what I mean to say.
It sounds almost like they doubled her voice a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like they had the main her talking, but then just very subtly, there's just a small echo of her voice repeated.
I like that. That's a nice little tweak for somebody who's supposed to have this voice that cannot be beat, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Perfect sense.
And that's when Zorg sees that the case is again empty. And
I'm like, how many stone switcheroos are there in this film?
I mean, at this point, I would have been like, I'm going to check this before I actually leave. But he was spending more time with Lilu. So,
well, who wouldn't if you had the chance?
Yeah.
Okay, so mine is, okay, so she's like, bleh, I am dead, right? The diva, by the way. The diva's like, bleh, I'm dead. Natural logic?
Yeah.
What's the natural logic?
We discussed this before recording. I said that I would probably be patting down on the stomach, feeling for organs or feeling for stones.
Squish my bits around. Find that thing. You don't know which part of my body, which orifice I put it in.
But if I was in the diva's position, I would be like, look, you're going to have to get right up inside me.
Instead of being like, who said to blame? Like, be cryptic and stuff. Be like, love her. That's the fifth element. And oh, sorry, ruined the plot for you. And then the rocks are inside my guts. You're going to have to get in my guts. Luckily, I just got perforated for your convenience.
Yeah.
He's like, Ruby Rod's laying next to him and there's a Mangalore on the ground. Corbin grabs the Mangalore by the throat, holds him to the ground, hands Ruby a gun and is like, hold this here. What do I do, my man? What do? And he's like, if he moves, shoot him. And he's like, oh, and he's weirdly complacent with this. Yeah. And then he's like, I gotta think. And then he starts rummaging around in her guts through her bullet wound.
And then he pulls out this massive stone.
They're huge.
And he says, Ruby, in a very, like, they're not whispering. He's saying it very much at full volume. And that's when the gun goes off.
He startles Ruby, who kills the Mangalore. I've never noticed that before. And I'm like, oh. Go, Ruby. Yeah. And Ruby's surprisingly cool.
Yeah. And that's when he fishes all of these other stones out, wraps them into his coat and gives them to Ruby and says, you need to watch these. You need to guard these with your life. Green. And he's just like, green. And he's like, super green, super green. And it's like, I really like Ruby at this point because he did what he was supposed to do. Corbin was the one who kind of like startled him and fired the gun. Mm-hmm. And then like Ruby's like, nope, I'm all up for this challenge.
Well, he's trying to make an entertaining show. And because this is the part of my notes where I'm like, they're all on the radio right now.
Yeah. Even the president is listening in on this.
He's like, way to be discreet. I know my man. I know. Like, you know your man from like 12 hours away. What? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And so the shot calls all of the other Mangalores around.
So they're separated now. Ruby's up. Corbin's down within this little mezzanine area. Corbin goes behind a bar. All the Mangalores know he's behind the bar, so they start shooting up the bar and he can't move. He's pinned down.
Right.
He looks across and under the billiards table, there is a deaf Roy.
Yeah.
Deaf Roy?
Deaf baby Roy, I think.
Baby Roy.
Yeah.
He's like, give me the gun. And deaf Roy's like,
it was like, me?
He's like, give me the gun. Deaf Roy, the baby Roy doesn't get it. Corbin tries to go out from behind the bar. They rocket launcher at him, blow up one third of the bar. Mm-hmm. He dives back behind the bar and he's like, Roy, give me the gun. And Roy's like, oh. And he's like crawling over a dead guy. And he's like, oh. And he's like, yes, yes, the gun. And baby Roy just rolls two billiard balls over to Corbin. And he's just like, you gotta be kidding me.
Yeah. And then the second rocket goes off. And there are like two rocket launchers on this thing. They both go off.
This weird turret they just happen to have with them.
Right. And then Mangalores catch him from above and being like, hey. And he's like, oh, don't shoot. I'm unarmed. You got the wrong guy. Even though they could very clearly see that he was the one coming through and shooting all of them up in this mezzanine.
Yeah.
But he's like, you know, distracting them and everything. And Ruby Rod is like coming out of the mezzanine. And he's like, I'm going to try and get a better look. And he's.
Yes. And he's like, he motions to Ruby, who's looking through a hole in the floor. He's like, go over that way.
Yeah.
And because what happened was one of the Mangalores is standing on, and let's just note this, the plotters, you've made it this far. This is the second movie in a row that has a seesaw bit in it. So the Mangalore's standing on one side of a lever. There's a fulcrum. There's a Bruce Willis at the top of the other side. And he jumps on it, shoots the Mangalore into the ceiling through a hole, and then Ruby Rod like jumps on his head and shoves him really, and the guy's shooting wildly, kills a whole bunch of his own guys. Mm-hmm. Ruby shoves his head down through the hole. He collapses to the ground, and that's when Corbin gets that Mangalore's gun.
Right, and then he goes ahead and starts shooting up any Mangalores that are still around. He gets like, he kneecaps the ones with the turret, which the turret had like, you know, guard in front of him, but not for the knees.
Yeah, so he shoots the legs out of these guys. And then we have like a grenade. This is the grenade part.
Right. So he picks up the grenade and he shoots Ruby from around where the hole is.
Yeah, he cuts Ruby out of the ceiling. He's like, stay still. And he's like, why? And he's like, ow!
Yeah.
he falls to the ground.
And then he pulls out the bomb and it's got these spikes on it. And he like turns the setting. He's like, count to 10. And then he thwinks it up underneath where they were just at.
And that's when I start counting.
And he says, count. And he's like, count to 10. And so he's like, what? He's like, count to 10.
Why am I counting to 10?
Yeah. And they get underneath that billiard table and they start like rolling it across the screen, across the floor.
Yes. And then I get to the count of like 20 and that's when it explodes.
Yeah. But I think that there is supposed to be a reason for it to specifically be 10. And I think mostly that's for the movie, for the audience, where Corbin says 10, that's when the camera shoots over to the bomb that Zorg went ahead and set up for like 20 minutes. And now that timer says 10.
Okay.
So all of this has essentially taken place in the course of like 10 minutes. And but we still have time. We still have like 10 minutes before his bomb goes off.
This is the scene where I noticed that Ruby Rod is a great wingman. A fantastic wingman. Like, he's the lead of his show. But when he falls in line behind Corbin, it's immaculate. Oh, I use that word too much. It is delicious. It is green, green, green.
Super green. Crystal green. Any green you want.
Yeah. Oh, now it's everybody's like in recovery from it. So like
not yet. We do see that we have 10 minutes left on the bomb.
We got to negotiate.
We got to negotiate because they got the leader who took over all of the military or all of the security guards. And so Corbin comes over to where the security is, going to take out the last of them.
He's got the super nervous guy who is a liaison to the diva, who's like now in charge and he has no idea what to do.
Right. And he goes ahead and says, is it all right if I take a look? And he's like, oh, yeah, you can take a look. And so he like, you know, moves him aside, gets into position, looks around very quick.
Seven on the left, five on the right.
And then he pulls out his gun, he shoots, and then he says,
four on the left, two on the right.
And then he's like, we got to take out the leader because Manglers won't fight without a leader. And
that's when he says, can I negotiate for you?
Right. It's like, there's the guy who says, another shot and we start killing hostages. And then he was like,
and he's holding Vito.
Yeah. And that's when they're saying, we're sending someone in to negotiate.
And he's like, hey, let's talk about the poof.
Yeah. And he shoots the leader right in the head. And then he was like, anybody else want to negotiate?
And they all are like, no.
Yeah.
No,
and then, then we cut to the president saying, I wonder where he negotiated.
And he like itches, the major itches behind his ear and kind of walks off screen. I'm like,
So
isn't that pretty much where that's the last scene we see of Mangalore's, right?
Not quite. There's one more shot right before the hotel explodes, but this is pretty much the last scene.
And I just want to just so I remember to mention it, the Mangalore's are wearing combat goggles, and that really was just a production choice so that they didn't have to add contacts and coloring and makeup around the eyes.
So it saves a lot of time.
Yeah.
Saves some time.
So
now we're in triage. Like, right. Everybody's strewn around like the ballroom, not the ballroom, the opera house. And they're and Ruby Rod's trio of guys, his yes men, are just like, Ruby, Ruby, Ruby.
And he's nowhere around because someone's like fishing things out of his hand.
He's just he's got like some cuts on his face, but he's merely having a splinter removed from his hand. And he's like, that's the end of the day of the show. Oh, no, he's not at the end of the day. He's just like, truly riveting, something, doesn't matter. The guy plucks the sliver and he's like, ow!
Yeah, and he hits him.
What's wrong with you?
And Corbin is looking specifically for Lilu and trying to find her. And that's when he sees like a hand dangling from the diva suite.
Mm-hmm,
and
then the vent.
Yeah, and he goes ahead and goes in there. He sees like the hand and then he pushes this piano underneath. And, you know, he like gently lifts her down. And Ruby is coming along with Vito into the room.
Yes, all of this has happened in 15 minutes.
Right. And we see the timer go down to 5 minutes. And Ruby notices it and he's like, what is that? And
the priestess Vito turns around and he's just staring at him. And this is one of the best lines from, but do you want to imitate it? Because I will.
Oh, no, you go ahead.
That's not a bomb. That can't be a bomb because all of these fancy hotels have bomb detectors. And then it goes.
And then the bomb detectors go off.
And saying, he spins around and presses himself back first in front of Vito. And he's like, it's so good. It's such a great reaction.
I know.
The timing of that part particularly was great.
Yeah. And so that's when they have to evacuate, and they have so many minutes to evacuate. And everybody outside of the core group of people are rushing to the emergency exits. And you see these lights come up from the floor, pointing into a direction to evacuate. And the core group of people, they rush over to the elevators. And as they're getting on the elevators, Zorg's getting off the elevators because mm-hmm, mm-hmm. it's his bomb. And he goes back to the Diva suite as they get onto his spaceship.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And all of these escape pods are leaving. And you hear the computer go, 1 minute until complete evacuation.
Right. And so they get onto his ship. Zorg gets over to the device and he pulls out this card and he very carefully slides it in. And then that stops it.
10 seconds to spare, but it actually counts out right. Mm-hmm. Back on the ship, Corbin's just driving a cab.
Right. And he goes ahead and blasts open doors so they can get through and everything. Well,
and then we cut to a Mangalore laying on the ground halfway dead, and he's just I forget what exactly he says. It's something
"for the honor," which is an interesting line because Zorg talked when he was talking about honor never really saved anybody, it only killed other people. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting that this line would come up later on with the people that he's been pretty much on in that speech.
Yes, I want to call it a dead man switch, but it's just an override switch that he happens to have that right. will set off the bomb.
And it's a bomb that will go off in 5 seconds.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And so after that bomb goes off right in front of Zorg, because the Mangalore's brought in this case that needs to just stays there. And that's where the bomb was.
Oh.
And it comes up from the Diva's suite as Zorg is coming back. And
suck it, Zorg.
Yeah.
Part 3 of our review of The Fifth Element is complete, but we still have one more segment left to bring you the end of our plot walkthrough, along with our great shocked and applaudable moments. Hey, this is your audio engineer and the real Corbin Dallas. I'm just showing up 200 years early for my flight. Airport lines, am I right? I'm keeping this week's message brief, but I wanted you to know how much we appreciate you as an applauder. That's all. It's hard to believe we've had over 3,500 downloads of our episodes so far, and that number is because you keep coming back to fill your ear holes with each new episode. We'll return with our conclusion of the review of this fantastic sci-fi film next week. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.